everybody. Representative Keen of the State Three Hearings, have the award. Yes, I present.
Yes, that's right. Council's name is Pierce. I'm here with Ms. Joanne Dowd for Aurora Energy Limited. So I'll just get straight into it if that's all right with the commissioners.
Absolutely. Just we have your preset way of the submission. Thank you for that. So you don't need to take us through that in detail, but if you would like to highlight anything, obviously please do.
I just have some brief oral submissions, which is essentially just a two-page summary of the submissions, the substantive submissions, just by way of putting everything into a nutshell that can be easily understood, and in particular the relief that is sought by Aurora, which has now been further refined in light of Council's opening a couple of weeks ago. So I'll just take you through that now. I have a written copy of the synopsis that I can send through afterwards. Okay. So Council appears here today for Aurora Energy Limited, who is the owner and operator of an electricity distribution network that sits between Transpower's transmission network and the electricity retailers, which provide a connection to individual properties. They supply electricity to approximately 90,000 homes in the Queenstown Lakes, Dunedin and Central Otago districts. Aurora is the primary electricity sub-transmission provider and has an extensive network of underground cables, overhead lines including supporting structures, transformers, zone substations and other infrastructure throughout the district. It has been well traversed that Aurora is to undertake a significant investment in its electricity distribution infrastructure, particularly in the Queenstown Lake District, which is experiencing high growth as well as a number of ageing assets. And this is particularly as a result of historic underinvestment. Aurora has sought to fund that work by way of a customised price quality path, which requires an application to the Commerce Commission and was filed on the 12th of June. A decision on that is expected in end of March next year. So that is required where the default price quality path isn't enough to provide for the investment that is required in the network. So the works to upgrade Aurora's network are ongoing, and regardless of the outcome of the application to the Commerce Commission, there will be a significant amount of investment in this district. What is clear is that there will be more work on Aurora's networks per year over the next 3 years than there has been for the previous years to date. The outcome of the CPP application will determine the scope of the works over the next 3 years, but in either case, Aurora seeks to ensure that it can undertake those works in an efficient and effective manner. The existing proposed district plan, being PDP stages 1 and 2, recognises the importance of Aurora's network, and Aurora have engaged in that process to seek greater clarity and recognition of the particular needs and the functional needs of its network. That recognition stems from the proposed Regional Policy Statement 2019, which has largely superseded the previous version and is operative insofar as it relates to regionally significant infrastructure. The support from the PRPS flows down into the strategic directions in Chapter 3 of the PDP, which seeks to ensure that infrastructure in this district can be upgraded efficiently and effectively to meet the community needs and to provide the functional needs of infrastructure that is of regional importance, including Aurora's network. In my submission, that recognition that the PDP is to provide for the functional needs of infrastructure is what has led to the permitted activity status of a number of activities relevant to Aurora's network in Chapter 30. Despite that recognition, the Section 32 evaluation does not assess the existing provisions which have led to those permitted activities against what has been included in PDP Stage 3 in terms of their efficiency and effectiveness for electricity distribution providers so that they can provide for the well-being of the community. That is, in my submission, what the council were directed to do by Section 32, Subsection 3 of the RMA, but they have not done so. For the reasons outlined in my substantive submissions, it is neither efficient nor effective to require resource consent for activities, particularly minor upgrading. I will attempt to summarise RORA's interest in this hearing in particular into two key issues. The first issue is earthworks in proximity to water bodies. The second issue is maximum volume threshold for earthworks in Wahitapuna areas. Both issues can be framed in terms of what the PDP already provides for in Chapter 25, Earthworks. Rule 25.328b is relevant to Aurora's network. The rule excludes earthworks for the placement of underground cables or lines. So for example, if Aurora had to install a brand new section of overhead line within a road or within private property, or a section of underground cable, it would not be inhibited by the rules in Chapter 25, including those rules which are sought to be introduced in PDP Stage 3. In my submission, it is appropriate to extend this rule to encompass minor upgrading. The basis for my submission is that the adverse effects of minor upgrading are inherently far less than what is anticipated by the installation of a brand new cable or line. Furthermore, minor upgrading only relates to existing infrastructure. So in terms of the changing what already exists in the environment, there will essentially be no change by and large. Aurora's refined position is based on the provisions that were introduced by Council in their opening submission, and that's what I rely on in terms of my substantive submissions. So just some final remarks. Consequential amendments are sought to Rule 25.328 to clarify that with respect to electricity distribution activities, which subclause B provides for, that lines include supporting structures. A line cannot be installed without a supporting structure, and Chapter 30 has a consistent approach in terms of referring to lines with their supporting infrastructure. Aurora simply couldn't install a line without also installing a pole. In my view, the amendment is only superficial and doesn't change the effect of this clause by adding the words supporting structures, and can be done so pursuant to a Clause 16.2 amendment as per the first schedule. Finally, it is submitted that Aurora's refined relief is appropriate to give effect to the strategic directions of the proposed plan, and on the basis that the activities which are sought to be excluded are activities which have effects that are no more than minor and temporary in terms of the environment. Thank you.
Yes, just picking up on that suggestion that Clause 16.2 might apply to include support structures. Mm-hmm. The current text reads earthworks for the placement of underground electricity cables or lines. I think that it's implicit in the submission you just made that you're reading a reference to lines as relating to overhead lines. I think Ms. Dow discusses what is a cable and what is a line in her evidence. But just as a matter of pure interpretation, doesn't the word with the adjective underground qualify both terms, underground cables or underground lines?
I agree that it is a confusing drafting, and that's why I had sought clarification from Craig Barr as to the interpretation of that, whether underground is in fact qualifying lines. There is essentially no difference. Ms. Dowd probably can speak to this better than I can, but a line, insofar as Aurora's network, can only refer to an overhead line. If a line were underground, it would be a cable. So there's a clear distinction in Aurora's, you know, practical sense of, you know, what they do, in that a line can only refer to an overhead line.
Like that's Aurora's practice, and for all I know, that may reflect a wider industry practice. I'm interested in this as an issue of pure interpretation, because I would have thought that if clause B had the meaning for which you contend, there'd be a comma after cables. I've always been taught that when an adjective is at the front or at the end, it applies to all the terms unless there's punctuation to separate them. So that, while I understand that you're pressing an interpretive purpose of interpretation, I have a concern that you're pushing the, back in the day, I was sort of a plain meaning of the words. So I think you need to explain to me why I'm not right.
I guess, it is a plain meaning interpretation, but I don't understand, and there isn't any commentary in the decision on PDP Stage 2, nor the Section 42A report which preceded it, which explains the particular drafting that has been adopted in that clause. So if, in fact, the commissioners, when the clause was drafted, had sought that lines only refer to underground lines, then they could have simply removed lines entirely. If your interpretation is correct, Commissioner, that it in fact refers to underground lines, well, that would be totally at odds with what electricity distribution providers understand of the term, and completely unnecessary in terms of the way that the clause is drafted. So I think that the intent of the clause was to refer to overhead lines, but there has been a misunderstanding and an inconsistency with what has been adopted in Chapter 30, which is to refer to lines and supporting structures, meaning only overhead lines.
Sorry, could I just maybe add to that? Just in the definition for minor upgrading, that's been included in the... Just adding a little bit of clarification to what Simon has said, under the definition of minor upgrading, it's actually included as Appendix 1 in our legal submissions. So the minor upgrading, Clause A.
It is in fact in the plan as it is now. There were amendments through Topic 17, but that didn't change the meaning of minor upgrading in terms of Clause A that Joanne's referring to.
Can you give me a page number?
It's page 18.
Oh, yes, here it is.
So just if Clause A is states addition of lines, circuits, and conductors.
You wouldn't normally go delving into one definition to try and interpret an undefined term.
What I was trying to do is that the term lines is used in a number of instances in the plan, and in that instance it refers to overhead.
I suppose.
I suppose I'm from an industry perspective, line circuits and conductors would only be applied to an overhead line. No, it doesn't.
So I think there are two points in that query. There, I'll deal with the point about the minor amendment pursuant to Clause 16.2. So that change would only be to add the words "and supporting structures" following the word "line" to clarify that it indeed refers to overhead lines and infrastructure. And in my submission, that is a minor amendment because it simply clarifies what Aurora already understands can take place pursuant to that rule. So I think that doesn't require scope if the commissioners accept that is a minor amendment to Clause 16.2. Correct. So if the commissioners accept that interpretation, then that would certainly then that would be a Clause 16.2 amendment in my submission. The other point I understand is that our original submission sought to exclude Aurora's already permitted activities from the maximum threshold of earthworks solely within Wahitupuna areas. And now what has been sought in my submission is to exclude the maximum volume earthworks from all activities. Sorry, all zones in the district. Is that the concern?
Well, you've added minor upgrade and you're seeking to add minor upgrade into this clause, which is actually to exclude them from all rules in Chapter 25 and just have them covered.
So Rule 25.328 already excludes a number of, all of the provisions of Chapter 25 insofar as they relate to underground cables or lines. So that much is known. Perhaps it's worth explaining what activities are actually anticipated by minor upgrading, which are relatively minor upgrades and simply refer to the replacement, something that increases the resilience capacity of a particular piece of infrastructure, so say replacing a like-for-like pole within the same location.
Yeah, I'm not going to go to the merits of it. You've explained that. Maybe it's a great idea. What I'm saying is, are you asking for more than what your submission asked for by adding minor upgrading into this global exclusion as opposed to adding it into a particular rule?
In my view, it's a good point you've raised. In my view, there is scope within the submission There was consequential relief sought in my overall submission, and my submission broadly, or Aurora's rather, was to seek to enable those types of activities which are already permitted. So. So I think there perhaps might be a scope issue, so that if the Commission is reminded to accept the relief, that perhaps they might refine that insofar as it relates to Wahi Tupuna areas, sure.
Assured by all parties that that was not the case, and I asked Mr. Barr some questions about how it would actually work if there was no overall balance. You seem to be suggesting that there should indeed be a balancing of different provisions, and so I wondered how that squared with assurances that Judge Jackson was given about how the RPS should be interpreted.
My understanding, having been involved in the tail end of the RPS, Aurora itself was involved in that process. The issue, which I understand it to be, was that the RPS implies that all provisions are to be assessed and be given effect to, but how in fact can that be done when there appears to be competing values? And I've summarised that in terms of attempting to strike a balance, but perhaps the more nuanced way to phrase that is to ensure that all elements of Aurora's, providing for Aurora's network, are provided for in the way that the objectives and policies require them to, in addition to providing for and recognising Wahi Tupuna values. There is an inherent sort of competition in the way that those objectives and policies are framed. So that's where this short phrase of striking a balance is, and that the objective is still to give effect to those provisions, but the question I presume that the commissioners will need to ask themselves is how can we give effect to the RPS provisions in relation to regionally significant infrastructure and the Wahi Tupuna provisions in the way that the RPS requires, and I understand is outlined in its introduction, in a way, and how is that then brought down into the PDP? And that is, in my submission, the way to give effect to that is by including minor upgrading, those things which happen on a day-to-day basis and which are really the essence of the functional needs of the network, is that those day-to-day activities are what keeps the network going. So I'm not trying to take an overall broad judgment approach, which has been signalled in King Salmon is not the way to go, but all provisions of the RPS do need to be given effect to.
When I asked Mr. Barr almost exactly the question you have posed, his answer was that it was a matter of assessing different provisions and the extent to which each provision is directive or not, and giving greater weight to the more directive provisions. Would you agree with that answer?
I think I would agree with that answer, and I heard a similar view from Craig Barr in the hearings on topic two before the Environment Court, so I have no issues with how he's answered that question, no.
And policy 2.2.2 is an avoid policy, which the Supreme Court told us in King Salmon is a directive policy, although that was in the context of the NZCPS, so should we take our cue from the directive nature of policy 2.2.2 and avoid, not the exact word, but it's something like that it was a values that were the significant values or significant adverse effects on the values that make up one.
I have no issues with the way that the Supreme Court has interpreted the word avoid. I guess I've now had the benefit of policy 2.2.2 in front of me, which says avoiding significant adverse effects, so significant being the operative word. In my submission, and what I believe has been supported in the evidence of Ms. Dowd, is that the exclusions which are sought in Aurora's submission do not have significant adverse effects. So if the Commission is reminded to accept the relief, they would not be allowing Aurora to undertake significant adverse effects on the environment. So I think granting the relief would be consistent with policy 2.2.2. So Aurora has engaged with Okaha to seek its views on what sort of adverse effects of Aurora's infrastructure are of concern. I won't go into any details about what that meeting was because it was on a confidential basis, but discussions with Okaha are hopefully ongoing. So that we can get a better understanding of what exactly the issues are in terms of Aurora's network for Karunaka. Having reviewed the evidence of Mr. Bathgate, my understanding was about the effects of concern are changing adding additional infrastructure into an environment which is otherwise not encumbered by an overhead line. So that would be through the installation of a new pole, perhaps within an O&L, which is a discretionary activity which would require consent and then come within the gambit of Chapter 39, and then there would need to be an assessment of whether there are in fact significant adverse effects. What we're seeking to exclude here is minor upgrading, which is focused on existing infrastructure, so there isn't actually any real change to the environment in terms of what already exists. So that was my understanding of Mr. Bathgate's evidence. There are, of course, a lot more nuances and a lot more discussion about that, but my view is that the significant adverse effects can be avoided by focusing on the existing infrastructure that's already in place.
And the last question I have for you relates to your paragraph 53. I didn't understand how you moved from a submission that the district plan doesn't add benefits to the environment over and above what the regional water plan provides, to the final sentence suggesting that the two are in conflict. Like I could understand you were saying to us that the district plan provisions are unnecessary, but why is there a conflict between the two?
I guess the conflict is simply in that the regional plan and the district plan are seeking a similar outcome, and yet one requires resource consent and the other does not. So, to put it simply, there is an inherent conflict in terms of how the regional and district authorities try to manage that outcome. And the conflict is that a resource consent is required for one but not the other. Well, I guess I would need to phrase that in terms of, or frame it in terms of, what are the functions of the different authorities in terms of the things that they are required to do. And for a regional council, it's to in relation to waterways themselves. And yes, they are indeed different, and perhaps I think being fixated on the word conflict, perhaps that's not where the discussion needs to be, but in terms of how are we seeking to manage these adverse effects, and what additional benefit does the district plan seek to provide that hasn't already been provided for in the regional plan.
And of course that comes squarely into the realms of Section 32. That is the Section 32. Is this the most effective and efficient way to proceed, or should the district plan lead it to the regional plan?
Correct.
Thank you. Mr. Wilson, any other questions?
No.
Mr. Smith?
Thank you. I'm just interested in, I suppose, what constitutes a minor upgrade versus a major or a new piece of infrastructure. Are you aware of the lines on Riverbank Road that were installed by Aurora relatively recently?
Yeah,
are you aware?
That's the large, the state of town.
You want to?
Yes.
Do they constitute a minor upgrade, or were they something different?
That was a redevelopment, but because it's in the road reserve, it's a permitted activity. That development occurred in the road reserve, and development of overhead lines generally is a permitted activity under the plan.
So that wouldn't have come under the umbrella of minor upgrading. It would have come under a different rule, which is to the installation of overhead lines within legal road, I think.
So if the Waihi-Tapuna area extended over a paper road, and I'm aware that the paper roads are often unzoned in this district, if you to apply that situation that we had a Waihi-Tapuna zoning, the
So are you?
I mean, if they hadn't been on a road and they'd been on private land, would that change have come within the definition of mine upgrade?
Yeah. But
that's
the
scale.
Yeah. If it met the parameters of the definition.
Well, that's what we're asking.
Yes.
You've provided, in your event, you've provided a bunch of examples of like-for-like replacements, where you've gone, replaced a wooden pole with a cement, a reinforced cement pole. What I'm trying to establish is if you added 5 metres of height and 3 cross members to that, would it still be deemed to be like a minor upgrade?
Yes, under the definition it would.
It would?
Yeah. So at the moment...
So you're referring to minor upgrade?
Yeah.
Definition. So here it is, yeah. So, for example, in, but no more than 3 metres here.
So yeah, it's no more than... if you look at the actual definition that's in it, so it's no more than 3 metres. So if it went above 3 metres, then it's no longer minor upgrading, and it then either requires a consent or it's considered under the rules of the plan. So again, if it's in a road, then there it could go ahead, and that would be the same on a paper road.
So, but I think the question is, could Aurora just simply go ahead and whack in a 20-metre pole in replacement of an 11-metre pole, They might, well, I don't know if that exists, but they would only seek to increase the height of the pole if they were required to meet NZECP 34. So that sets out the minimum safe distances from a conductor, being the line itself on the support structure, to the ground, or if an area below the line has been built up over time, it might need to be increased, or if there's a structure nearby which isn't going anywhere, then it might need to be increased as well. And that's to prevent sort of the swinging of the lines themselves getting into contact with anything. The goal is essentially public safety. So Aurora, it costs more money essentially if Aurora were to increase the height of the pole, and they would only do so if that would ensure public safety.
Yeah, I understand that. What I'm interested in the effects of those, and you've made a case that to us effectively not to worry about upgrades because they're like it's existing, but you've also made a concession that there's opportunity for a significant increase in effects through the size and the nature of the infrastructure required that would be covered by that exemption. So, you know, and how can we gain some comfort that there aren't additional effects on Wahi Tutuna Valleys in this case, or Mount Benua Valleys in this case, as a result of upgrades?
Could I take that? I suppose what Aurora do at the moment in terms of archaeological sites is we obviously have archaeological authorities that are covered over the roads throughout the district, and we undertake a process with archaeological consultants that actually review the works that we undertake and assess whether archaeological monitoring is required. What we're proposing here is that similar situation could be applied to the Wahi Tapuna, and that we would undertake consultation with Okaha or whoever to get the feedback in terms of the works that we're undertaking. So it's a process that we are already undertaking and have done for the last 5 years, and we're in the process of applying for new archaeological authorities to make sure that process is continued.
And do you do that for minor upgrades, like the light pole replacements?
We have to. Yes. So at the moment, if any of our works occur in a red zone, say all of Arrow Town's in a red zone, then we need to have an archaeologist look at it.
So in the case of a pole replacement or a minor upgrade, generally, the conditions of the archaeological things refer to, monitoring and ensuring that any artifacts found are reported and stop work orders and things like that.
Yeah.
to a Waiheke Puna value, which is around a landscape value, you know, would you actually change tack and run the line somewhere else? Would you, what I'm saying is you can't just apply conditions to solve the problem if it runs, if there's a fundamental location or landscape value. How would you approach that?
I admit that would be difficult with existing infrastructure, so we'd probably end up having a bigger impact if we had to move an existing line to address an issue like you've outlined. If it's a new overhead line, then there is the ability to actually avoid particular areas, and that's where the consultation would come in for new works. But I agree, for existing works that would be difficult.
Is it comparable to compare archaeological things with the Waiheke Puna values that have been discussed in this chapter?
We have suggested it as another sort of process that we could work with Okaha or Karonga, Karanoka, to try and address how we would work outside a regulatory framework to make sure that their issues were addressed and that the network obviously could be developed.
And for an activity that is effectively permitted by the, well, you're asking to be permitted by the rules, are we reliant on the goodwill of Aurora to undertake that engagement and consultation on benefit or value, not benefit or values?
I suppose the answer would be yes. I mean, basically that's what we do with the archaeological sites. But again, you know, we want to be, you know, working in partnership with the organisations that operate in the district. So again, it's something that we could put a formal agreement in place, a memorandum of understanding, but that would be something that we'd need to have further discussion with Okaha to understand how that would work. But there are mechanisms to secure that outcome, so it's not goodwill.
Yeah, I'd be interested to look at that. I suggest that some in this district might undertake that relying on the goodwill of Aurora is not a strong position
yeah.
for this community.
What I would draw your attention to is I know Chorus operate some type of agreement with iwi. In terms of a consultation processes that they need to undertake. So there is precedent that it has occurred in other places in New Zealand. And again, it could be applied here. And Aurora would welcome the opportunity to work with Okaha to look at how that might work. Not at the moment, no.
Just some final comments on that, Commissioner. I think the concern for Aurora is really the administrative exercise of requiring resource consent in every particular instance where minor upgrading would be required. So there's no dispute that consultation is required, and that is something that has gone on at Aurora for a number of years and is hopefully will continue in the future. I guess it's a question of what is the most efficient and effective way of ensuring that consultation does indeed take place and those concerns, as Commissioner Smith has outlined, are indeed taken into account, so that if Aurora perhaps is proposing to install a larger pole, that there is indeed some consultation that does take place and that the council has some confidence that that is being done, while also providing for the functional needs of the network. So it's a balance, to bring that word back again, in terms of how in fact do we ensure that takes place in an efficient and effective way. The concern is for Aurora, does that have to be by way of a resource consent in every particular instance and requiring individual reports and that sort of thing? There's certainly that opportunity, but in terms of it, how works are planned, Joanne, do you have any comments on how that might work?
It's of course it's reasonable. I mean, it can be done. We do it in other areas of the district. Again, I suppose with our works, they fall into sort of either day-to-day planned works that we know that we need to do. Then we've got emergency works. And again, they can just happen at any particular time, so they're unforeseen circumstances. So it's just the ability to include things like that where it's not foreseen that we needed to undertake the work. That's correct, yes.
So, what provisions would you be relying on there? Would that be considered to be a minor upgrade, or is that going to be something else, given that the capacity and the nature of the structures is likely to increase significantly?
It could be a mixture of things. It depends on the height of the pole. So some of those poles have already been replaced, and it would just be a case of additional equipment that's actually placed on the pole that would raise the voltage. So at the moment, the two lines run at 33 kV, and then it'd be the potential to operate them to 66 kV. Or alternatively, a decision could be made that we would go to 100 kV and need significantly bigger structures, and that would be a new application. So that's the whole sort of planning work that's going on behind the scenes at the moment. It would still be on poles. We don't really have a lot of pylons on our network, and generally it's the steel construction type pole that would be installed. Again, the height of those particular structures is determined by NCD CP34, so it would be safety distances for a voltage of that particular type.
Amenity and landscape, which does cross over into Waihi Tupuna,
of that particular project?
Yeah.
Personally, in that particular development, those larger poles actually replaced 28 other poles plus service poles. So ultimately, the clutter that was on the streetscape was ultimately reduced. So there could be an argument that there was actually an improvement in the landscape rather than a negative impact, but I mean, that's my view.
Okay. I suppose what I'm getting at is I'm concerned that Aurora's view of the world might be different to other people's view of the world because of their needs to provide efficient results. I'm just concerned that that might cross over into this realm as well, to the Waikato Planet realm as well. Assurance can you give me that this is, there's real intent here to consider these values?
I think I can only just reiterate that Aurora wants to, you know, we've got a customer focus and obviously want to make sure that we've got enduring relationships with the organisations that we need to work to in the district. You know, we've a lot of work that needs to be done on the network, and we can't do it alone. So I think it's just, I don't want to say goodwill, but I mean, there is a real desire to make sure that our network is brought up to standard, and not at any cost. It is a case of looking at the environment around us and looking at other measures that need to be put in place, you know, through public consultation, archaeological authorities. You know, it's not just me here, it's our sort of our business strategy.
I wonder, Commissioner, we seem to have sieged into Ms. Downs, into Ms. Downs' evidence. Yes, I was there. We'll pick up any final questions.
Okay.
Sorry to go back to where I was before, mm-hmm. Yes, but have you got 25328 in front of you, and it's in your on page 17, in the scouts, evidence on page 17?
I believe I've summarised it in my evidence, so I'll just pull that up, or not summarised, replicated it largely.
On page 17 in your summary?
Yes, I have that in front of me.
So, what do you make of, just a moment, what do you make of course C in terms of your argument about underground not applying to lines?
Yes. When I first read this rule, I had a similar understanding as I believe you're conveying, is that, well, does this also apply to Aurora? And I've since gone back to the Commissioner's decision on Chapter 25 and the Section 42A report which preceded it, which made it clear that Clause C applies to the telecommunication lines, not Aurora's network.
Okay, so it doesn't say that in the provisions, does it?
No, it's not.
So C is intended to apply to telecommunication lines, which are about to be underground, but it doesn't apply to electricity lines, which in Aurora's view are never underground.
Correct, because they would be a cable.
Okay, so for your purposes, or Aurora's purposes, you ignore C and want B to be workable.
I think C would be helpful, more helpful than B, to be quite honest.
Yes, yes.
But it's
because it allows for alteration or addition.
Correct, but I couldn't say to you right now that it does apply to Aurora because I've checked that out and it indeed doesn't.
Or
so, yeah.
All right. I mean, I suppose maybe amendments are needed to this clause to clarify it in all sorts of ways, or maybe even for the communications providers. But I suppose my previous point was, is your submission on the Waikitupuna topic the way to do this? I mean, does it give you scope to sort out the schools? And you're saying perhaps it doesn't, perhaps we need to be careful about how far to look at what you've asked for in relation to Waikitupuna overlays rather than being
think I would really I'd need to have a detailed look at what exactly our submission asked for. But from my recollection, it was quite wide, and certainly PDP Stage 3 has put at issue a number of zoning requirements and as well overlays in the district. But yeah, I would need to have a detailed look at that. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
We've already heard from you at some length, but let's just sort of circle back. And is there anything you want to say to us about the presentation of your evidence? This is obvious, we've all read it. And so.
Not really. I think most of the points of relief have been highlighted in the legal submissions from Mr. Pearce. Yeah, so I think that kind of summarised nicely the case that we're trying to put forward. Again, a lot of what the maintenance and upgrade works that we would be proposing is literally replacing existing structures with a new structure that will elongate the life of the asset. That they don't necessarily need to increase in height. The minor upgrading just gives us an envelope in terms of what we could do, but as in the main, it's just literally replacing like for like, so the impact would be significantly the same. It's quite difficult to answer because of the range of works that we need to undertake. So some of it is literally just pole replacement. Some of it is having to upgrade it to improve capacity. So there's lots of different activities that need to occur. And without actually sitting down and assessing each of the Waiheke Puna areas individually, which I haven't done in terms of our 5-10 year work programme, it's quite difficult to answer. But that's obviously why we are offering to sort of work with Aucaha in terms of our future development plans so that we can understand if there would be or likely to be a significant impact.
Just one last question. Do you have any ballpark on what percentage of your network is located in road reserves versus across private land or easements or
Yeah, so in Queenstown Lakes District it's about 50%.
Sorry,
50%, so 50% in the road reserve and 50% in private property. When this evidence was written, it was only supposed to apply to the Waiheke Te Puna areas, so we're certainly not looking to extend the scope beyond those areas.
I just wondered if the label
that amended rule, which deleted structures from Chapter 39, was of great assistance. The reason for that is Aurora's infrastructure is a structure, but it's not a building, and it's expressly excluded in the Building Act. So taking that out and having the intent of that rule being located in Chapter 25 is certainly of great assistance to Aurora and what has led to the refined relief, which has been summarised in my submission. So if the refined relief we've outlined today is accepted, then all the relief that we've sought in our submission in relation to Wahi Tupuna would be resolved.
So the relief that we sought was to exclude minor upgrading, so we did that through submission, and that was accepted in Dunedin. Good morning, everybody, and thank you for providing me the opportunity to talk to my submission regarding the Wahi Tupuna placed by Ngā Tahu on 1147B Lake Hawea, Albert Town Road, which is the land that has been owned by my family trust since 2016. I own the 10.3 hectares, which is on the lower eastern slopes of Mount Maud, which is right opposite the Lake Hawea golf course, and it's divided by State Highway 6. The land is zoned rural general in the ODP and rural in the PDP. Approximately 1.5 hectares is flat land adjoining the Lake Hawea Albert Town Road, and the remainder, 8.8 hectares, is ONL land with an approximate gradient going up of about 60 to 70 degrees.
Ms. Kenton, before you go on, we ask you to
I've got a couple of pictures that zoom in closer. Would that help for me to give those? So it's that one there. Correct.
Directly opposite the tennis field.
Correct. So when the original QLDC approval of the subdivision on Mount Maud was done approximately 15 years ago, access to the lower part of my property was not feasible, as the first 10 metres to the south of the main entranceway is owned by my neighbours at 1147A. This existing right-of-way does not connect to the lower part of my site and only provides access to the upper part of the site. Consequently, the physical access between the right-of-way and the lower portion of the site was reliant on the approval of the owner of 1147A as temporary only, and it's not protected by legal rights. The ONL line that's mapped on my property is incorrect, as confirmed by the QLDC landscape architect Renee Davies when I put in my resource consent. And that's because the land was mapped aerially, and there was 50 metres of bracken and broom and blackberry from the base of the hill eastwards, which was actually flat, but because they did it from the air, they couldn't actually tell where the hill started and stopped. So I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a planner, I haven't read the RMA back to front and inside out, so I'm not going to sit here and quote sections to you today, and I'm certainly not an expert in Māori history. When I attended a meeting at the Lake Hawea Community Centre on the 14th of November with both Sarah and Marie in attendance, they asked me to put my concerns in my submission, because they said in response to my concerns that they were seeking clarity. So I'm not going to read my 44-page submission to you today, as I'm going to assume it's pre-read. My focus today will be on talking to the most salient objections that I've raised, and I'm happy to address any questions you may have at the end of my 10 minutes. So firstly, I've opposed Ngāi Tahu's wāhi tupuna mapping of my land as per submissions outstanding 3197.2, 3 and 4. Ngāi Tahu's response to my submission on this matter is the values are on the QLD website. The information is on the Ngāi Tahu Atlas, where they have digitally mapped areas of significance on the Kahuru Manu website, and it's not possible to provide title-level information for all titles, and the values are on the website. So if I take each of these responses and talk to them as follows. Firstly, my property falls within Area 2, and the values are related to food gathering, traditional settlement, and traversement over land. I fully accept that Māori did travel inland in warmer months, gathered food and settled, and I have no doubt as to the importance of these values to Ngāi Tahu. Secondly, I have gone to the Kahuru Manu website and I've asked for it to be available today during my talk. And when I've typed in Mount Maud, nothing comes up except its location. However, when I type in the Hawea River and Lake Hawea in the neck, areas come up in the digital atlas with stories related to them. So if Mount Maud was an area that was traversed over and had food gathered on it and was settled on, then why isn't that showing in the digital atlas that Ngāi Tahu have had 7 years to update? And why did Ngāi Tahu advise in their response to my submission to go to this website to understand why my property is mapped that way when there is no reference to it in the website? Further, Marie, I'm sorry, I can't say her surname. She's sitting behind me today.
All right.
Quite hard. Said that the mapping doesn't follow cadastral boundaries, and that's evident in the mapping of Wanaka and Lake Hawea areas. But when you actually look at the mapping, particularly on my land, it actually doesn't really make a heck of a lot of sense, because it kind of comes down, does a dog leg, and then comes back. And it actually looks like, to me, it's been mapped in a way so as to include every property north of me. Ngāi Tahu's third response to my submission is that they could not possibly have title-level information for all titles. And Edward Allison's submission on behalf of Ngāi Tahu's is that the broad mapping of the wāhi tupuna avoids Ngāi Tahu having to publicly identify individual sites of importance to them, and that it's incomprehensible that they would try and talk about the story by placing dots on a map. But I guess the thing that confuses me is, isn't that Ngāi Tahu's 7-year project to digitally map their places of importance
And isn't that what the kahuru manu actually does? So it's equally incomprehensible to me as a landowner that my land could be mapped without Ngāi Tahu responding to my requests seeking to understand why. I can only do a back of the envelope guess as to the number of property owners asking this. And so this is pure guesswork, but I heard that there were about 3,000 properties mapped and there were about 1,000 submissions. So let's assume, based on population, that a third of those were Wanaka and Hawea, so we're down to about 333. And let's assume that 80% of landowners in Wanaka and Hawea have properties sized 1,000 square metres or less. That leaves you with about 70. And how many submissions have repeatedly asked Ngāi Tahu to help them understand why their land has been mapped the way it has been with no response? And based on the lack of meaningful consultation, have them opposed their the mapping of their property? I would suggest less than half of that 70. Then how many property owners have close to 40,000 cubic metres, which is the equivalent to about 50 landowners in Lake Hawea, based on the average size being 800 square metres, of their land mapped? I would suggest that you're probably down to 20. So I therefore don't accept that an answer as to the mapping of my property cannot be based on that number. On behalf of Ngāi Tahu, Michael Bathgate's proposed amendment number 85 is that earthworks over 10 cubic metres does not need to apply to the urban areas. In areas below 400 metres above sea level and earthworks that modify a skyline. So my home sits at 438 metres above sea level. So if Michael Bathgate's proposal is accepted, it's still one that I oppose, as it would require me to go to Ngāi Tahu and to the QLDC every time I want to dig up 10 cubic metres of mapped land to plant some veggies in my garden where my home is located. So I believe my land has been inaccurately mapped by Ngāi Tahu, and I continue to request its removal. Now, I was going to talk to this at the end, but I've had a pretty sleepless night based on something that happened on my property yesterday, and I'm pretty upset about it, but I need to talk about it. So less than 24 hours ago, the timing of which is particularly relevant to me being here today, at the entrance to coming into my property, it says private property. And then at the moment, I'm turning left and I'm driving over my neighbour's land. And there is a health and safety board up there because I have felled trees on the land, I've got huge mulching piles, and I have a building site. And on that board, it clearly stipulates anybody entering my property to contact me so that I can take them through those health and safety concerns. Yesterday, a gentleman drove onto my property and parked up where my barn is currently being built. And he got out of the car, and two men who are currently working on that property approached them, and he asked who they were. They both identified themselves, and he gave them his name, and he said he used to be a BNZ bank manager, and that the reason he was there was because he had heard a rumour that greenstone had been found on my property and was there to engage with them to find out if it was true. He advised them both that he was there to take photos and that no one would know anything. This gentleman offered to place greenstone on my ground to show them what it looked like and to take a photo of it. The guys working on my property said, "It won't be necessary." And then they proceeded to engage this gentleman regarding the fact that both of their families had lived in Hawea and Wanaka and Cardrona for over 100 years, and he advised them he'd lived in the area for 30. They also advised him that there was no truth to the rumour of greenstone being found on my property, and that if he really wanted to start a rumour, it was better to start one that was true, which was that the property owner had removed a significant number of wilding pines from her property and was progressively planting it out in natives, to which the gentleman asked, "What natives are they?" Their comments to me last night that this gentleman was clearly on a witch hunt, and the two gentlemen working on my property were both my stepbrother and my cousin. The gentleman who visited my property uninvited yesterday and who offered to take photos of greenstone that he found, that he brought with him and wanted to place on my property, identified himself as Richard Hewitt. When I googled that name last night, I discovered that Richard Hewitt is a historian for Ngāi Tahu. And then I thought, you know what, that's got a familiar ring to it, because when I went to the meeting at Lake Hauwea Community Centre on the 14th of November, I talked about my property and I talked about the fire that happened on Mount Maud in October 2018, and I talked about that I had the ability to remove wilding pines from my property and never feel that fear that I felt when I drove down that road filled with smoke. And there was a gentleman behind me and said, I know this young lass's property. And there was a piece of greenstone found a couple of properties away from here. And I can't help but think, was that the same man? For someone to come to my property and indicate that there is a rumour that I have been unlawful, that I have found greenstone and not declared it, and that I'm not complying with the Archaeological Act, has caused me a very sleepless night. I have tremendous respect for Sir Tipene O'Regan. I come from a commercial fishing family. And to have had that happen, I believe, completely compromises the integrity of the work that Ngāi Tahu have done. So I'll leave it to Ngāi Tahu to determine the acceptability of his actions. My next concern has been about the limited opportunities to meaningfully consult with and be appropriately informed by the QLDC and Ngāi Tahu consultancies ahead of this submission. I've submitted my evidence as per my numerous attempts to engage with Ngāi Tahu, my request to QLDC to be informed, meetings I've asked to be scheduled, and I actually can't help but feel that there's been one of deliberate obstruction in trying to answer my questions. You will see from my evidence the contrary guidance I've received from people within Ngāi Tahu and QLDC as to my need to engage with Ngāi Tahu on the resource consent that I submitted to the QLDC on the 31st of August, which was 2 weeks prior to my receiving notification from QLDC and the Ngāi Tahu's Wahutupuna mapping of my land. I attended the first meeting on the 25th of September with the QLDC, and there was no Ngāi Tahu representation there. There was about 50 people, and I was the very first person to ask questions. And I asked N. Bayliss and 4 other planners in attendance, of which Sarah Picard was one, to bring up the property on my screen. And I specifically asked N. Bayliss, do I need to go to Ngāi Tahu in respect of my existing resource consent? And I was advised no, given that it was a proposal in consultation only. And on the 5th of November, I was advised by the QLDC processing planner that after a very long drawn-out process, I needed to go to Ngāi Tahu to gain their approval. So I went back to Ian Bayliss and I said, what's going on? His response was that normal practice for implementing a proposed district plan under the RMA is that new rules do not have any legal effect when notified and until decisions are released on submissions. This approach applies to the Chapter 39 Wahutupuna provisions and the associated maps. In my view, it should also apply to all the provisions in the plan that relate to the Wahutupuna, as they will apply as a package, and it is problematic to try and implement parts of the package introduced through earlier stages of the plan review or at this time, given the current uncertainty about the final form. So I also asked Ian Bayliss, do I need to go and get an affected party approval from Ngāi Tahu for my existing resource consent? And his response was no. When I went to Ngāi Tahu's consultation on the 14th of November, Marie talked to the requirement for anyone applying for a resource consent to have an affected party approval from Ngāi Tahu first. On the 28th of November, I was advised by my contracted planning company that Emily Grace of the QLDC policy team had advised planners in the Wanaka area that the legal advice they had received back was that Wāhi Tupuna provisions did not have immediate legal effect. I then contacted the QLDC processing planner for my consent on the 3rd of December for my, and was advised, we hope to have clarity for you very soon. And on the 9th of December, when the artificial 20-day clock of resource consents had run out, and I was actually officially on 70 working days, I sent Ian Bayliss an email about my continuous delays, and his response, we've recently received legal advice that in most instances, the Wāhi Tupuna proposals have immediate legal effect on notification, which is different to what we had planned for when provisions were developed and notified. I therefore think sending information about your plans to the two Ngāi Tahu addresses sounds like good advice. Apologies for the confusion and inconvenience this has caused. The timing of the receipt of this advice is unfortunate, but the approach being now recommended to us was not at all obvious when we originally looked into the relevant parts of the RMA, related case law, and what other councils have done. However, I've never received formal notification from the QLDC advising that these Wāhi Tupuna rules have immediate effect, and neither have my neighbours. So if I talk to the lack of meaningful consultation alluded to earlier, if the Wāhi Tupuna proposals have immediate legal effect on notification, then how is this consultation process meaningful when it's predetermined and the rules have immediate legal effect? So on the 11th of December, based on Ian Bayliss's advice, I then went to Ngāi Tahu and I said, what do I need to do? How much is this going to take? How much is it going to cost? And I did appreciate the very fast response I received from Phoenix Hale, who came back to me with those answers. And on the 11th of December, I sent an email to Mayor Jim Bolt expressing my frustration. He responded on the 12th of December saying, I've asked for a report into that matter. And later that afternoon, I had to go back to Ngāi Tahu consultants and I had to ask them to cease work because I'd been advised my resource consent had been granted. And on the 19th of December, I received the formal approval of that. Now, everybody knows in this town, when you get something on the 19th of December, you might as well get it in mid-February. And then once you get that resource consent approval, I've then had to go to NZTA. And then I've got to go through 15 days of corridor access requests. So as you can imagine, when did I start work on my road entrance? When did COVID lockdown come along? When did we come out of lockdown? When do you asphalt entrances when it's not too cold? So I'm going to have to redo the compaction of my entrance prior to the asphalting resumes, you know, when it resumes in October. Will there be more costs? Have I had to extend construction insurance? When I've actually added up all of the downstream impacts of QLDC's misinformation on the 25th of September versus if they'd actually told me, no, go to Ngāi Tahu and engage, I would have commenced consultation with them on the 26th of September. Had the resource consent been approved in early November last year, because Ngāi Tahu told me it would take about a month to do what they needed to do, my road and barn would have been completed prior to lockdown. So QLDC, your incorrect initial advice on me contacting Ngāi Tahu has meant I've got compounding delays that this year will cost me in excess of $10,000, which to a lot of people may be chicken feet. But that's $10,000 I'm not spending employing somebody to cut down wilding pines and replace that with natives. QLDC and Ngāi Tahu, I strongly urge you to work more closely together, mapping your processes, ensuring your roles and responsibilities are clearly defined, and most importantly, ensuring you are aligned. It's vital when you are deploying a change of this manner. The lack of clarity, which you should have had prior to starting engagement with property owners, has meant I've experienced delays, significant costs, and considerable stress, which I can only describe as particularly cruel. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions the commissioners may have.
I think what you've raised is very clear. All I can say to you is that we have to be asking
Yep, and I haven't questioned that. So what I've questioned is that they've walked up 70 degrees of land. So, you know, I don't doubt, I've got no reason to doubt that that they did traverse some land. But the thing that I probably struggle to get my head around is the neighbour to the south of me has got far, far, far more flatter land than me, and it just seems very strange, given that mapping, that they wouldn't have traversed that part. So, yeah.
You talked about some vegetation, but effectively at the bottom of the trees is the flatter ground,
mm-hmm.
and that is only a relatively small part of your site.
Mm-hmm. It's about 1.5 of the 10.3 hectares. Come around and point it out, or I can,
yes.
Is it right?
Yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, I'm just making sure that I understand.
If it was to do with walking along the flatland at the bottom, just a little snippet of your flatland has been covered, but the properties to the south, which are flatter and wider, aren't included.
Ooh, that's completely flat. So it's like, well, how come they've done here and they didn't build here?
Thank you.
Exactly. Yeah. So thank you very much for coming to see us.
Right, thank you.
Very much appreciated. Thank you a lot to talk to Renata about next Tuesday.
Thank you.
Ken is the last spotter. We're adjourned until 9 a.m. on the 21st.